Good evening, everyone. My name is Andrew Grimwade, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all, and especially to welcome our very distinguished keynote speaker, Professor Sir David Cannadine of Princeton University. I also welcome any visitors to Melbourne and to this university. I acknowledge we're meeting on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and I pay our respects to their elders both past and present. And I especially acknowledge Trinity College, Melbourne, and it's represented by its Dean and other colleagues here tonight for their valuable support of this event. Trinity has supported the 2011 festival by bringing the 2011 Caldwell Lecturers, Sir David and Professor Linda Colley, to Australia. This fulfils the intent of the Colin Hicks Caldwell Trust to attract notable international scholars in the field of art, history, law, or literature. Tonight we're governed by those ancient laws which require you to check that you've turned off your mobile phone, although my grandchildren say you're allowed to tweet any pages and similar instruments. Finally, the whole session is being filmed, and if we have time for questions at the end, I'd ask you to, and you don't wish to appear on film, then please refrain from asking questions. It's beyond dispute that historians are the gods of academia, or so they tell me. I'm just a simple chemical engineer. If historians are indeed gods, then Professor Sir David Cannadine is their Zeus, the most powerful of all the gods, ruling from that modern-day Olympus known as Princeton. He strides the landscape of historians like none other, for he's a most notable international scholar, and he brings preeminent scholarship to this festival, rivaled only by that of Princeton's most illustrious professor of history, Linda Colley, his wife. Having previously held positions at Cambridge, Columbia, and London universities, he's now based at Princeton University, and since 2008, he's been the Whitney J. Oates Senior Research Scholar within the Council of the Humanities. He's also a lecturer in history and is an author working within this New World University. So that he doesn't lose touch with the old world of Europe, Sir David is Chairman of Trustees of the National Portrait Gallery in London. He's Vice Chairman of the Editorial Board of Past and Present, widely acknowledged, as you would all know, to be the liveliest and most stimulating historical journal in the English-speaking world. Not surprisingly, his CV encompasses an amazing 20 pages. If I was to go through that, of course, there'd be no time for him. He's the author of a series of hugely influential studies of the British aristocracy, the monarchy, and class at home and in the colonial empire. Sir David's also the biographer of G.M. Trevelyan and Andrew Mellon. He's one of the finest historical essayists of his generation, and his most recent collection, Making History Now and Then, Discoveries, Controversies and Explorations, was published to great acclaim last summer. His current project includes a study and questioning of collective identities from religious wars to the clash of civilizations and beyond. He was knighted in the UK in 2009 for services to education and to scholarship. At that time, he expressed his delight, quote, that history had been singled out in this way with the hope that such recognition will encourage and embolden all those who care about the importance of history. So tonight, we have this great anomaly of a patrician British knight based in egalitarian America, which provokes, of course, an irreverent limerick. There once was a knight from Princeton. Others in history he outshone. Of course, noble he rates, yet a knight in the States is surely an oxymoron. Please welcome the Zeus of history, this transatlantic oxymoron, to deliver tonight's keynote lecture entitled Construction of National Identities.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Sir Andrew, for an introduction of such overwhelming kindness and generosity that it leads me to think that if I might rework a familiar word pattern in your hands, flattery is the sincerest form of intimidation. I ought also to say that I don't have many very well-born or grand friends, but one of them did say to me at the point when, having written a book called The Decline and Fall of the British Aristocracy, I was given a knighthood. They said, well, it's absolutely clear that the aristocracy has declined and fallen if people like you are getting titles. It's a huge pleasure to be here, to be back in Australia, which I always find wonderfully exhilarating and life-enhancing, and it's a particular pleasure to be back in Melbourne, to be accommodated in Trinity College in a very splendid and hospitable way, and to be playing some part in this marvellous festival of ideas devoted to identities. Insofar as I have any claim to have anything serious or, I hope, relevant or helpful to say on this subject, related to this theme, it is, as the introduction suggested, that I'm struggling at the moment with a book pretentiously entitled Common Humanity, where I'm trying to look at what seem to me to be the six most significant collective identities that are kind of available to us all today, those of religion, nation, class, gender, race, and civilization. And I'm particularly interested at the way in which these identities are constructed, often around simple Manichaean binary distinctions. I'm particularly interested in the fact that at different occasions people say that one of these identities is more important than any of the others. Well, if they're all saying that, as it were, they can't all be right, and there's a kind of problem there. And I'm also interested in the way in which they each, as it were, undercut the other. And so national identity, when I was asked to come and talk here today, was a subject I had been working on and thinking about in that context. And so what I'd like to talk about tonight is national identity, perhaps to some degree in that slightly broader context. Can I begin with General Charles de Gaulle? His peacetime memoirs, which begin with his return to power in France in 1958, opening not wholly unexpectedly with an eloquent and emotional evocation of national history, national geography, national genius, and national identity. France's, of course. France, de Gaulle writes, has emerged from the depths of the past. She is a living entity. She responds to the call of the centuries, yet she remains herself through time. Accordingly, although somewhat paradoxically, de Gaulle goes on, her boundaries may alter, but not the contours, the climate, the rivers and seas that are her eternal imprint. For, he insists, her land is inhabited by people who in the course of history have undergone the most diverse experiences, but whom destiny and circumstance, exploited by politics, have unceasingly moulded into a single nation, which comprises a past, a present, and a future that are indissoluble. As a result, de Gaulle goes on, the state, which is answerable for France, is in charge at one and the same time of yesterday's heritage, today's interests, and tomorrow's hopes. Across a millennium and a half, de Gaulle believed, these obligations had been successively discharged in the name of the French nation by the Merovingians, the Carolingians, the Capetians, the Bonapartes, and the Third Republic, whereupon he was himself twice invested with supreme authority as he sought to lead the country to salvation by offering his compatriots no other goal but that of the summit and no other road but that of endeavour. Such for de Gaulle was the enduring character of the unique, venerated, and venerable French nation, embracing countless generations of the dead, the living, and the as yet unborn, the ultimate embodiment and expression of the most significant and long-lasting form of collective human solidarity, awareness, consciousness, and identity. Charles de Gaulle was born in 1890 and died in 1970. So his vivid sense of France's enduring and exceptional national identity is scarcely surprising, for his life virtually coincided with what has often been described and sometimes deplored as the apotheosis of the nation-state. From the time of the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, so this argument runs. The collective religious identities and antagonisms of faith were gradually superseded by the collective secular identities and antagonisms of the nation. Hence the great powers which dominated Europe during the 18th and 19th centuries. Hence the creation of the United States as a new nation soon followed by the Latin American republics to the south. Hence the revolutionary and Napoleonic wars, which unleashed and provoked across Europe the pent-up forces of romantic nationalism. Hence the nation-making that characterized the continent across the 19th century in the decades culminating in the First World War. Hence the Treaty of Versailles, which reorganized Europe according to the principle of national self-determination. Hence post-war decolonization, when new independent countries were created across the globe as the European empires were dismantled. And hence, 2 decades after de Gaulle's death, the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the emergence or re-emergence of many old new nations in Eastern Europe and Asia. From this perspective, it seems clear that initially across Europe and subsequently around the world, people have increasingly come to think of themselves and to organize themselves in nationalities. And the result, according to Ian Tyrrell, is that in modern times, collective human identities, though multiple, are in some ways global, have become primarily national identities. It seemed then particularly appropriate that during the years between the death of Charles de Gaulle and the breakup of the Soviet Empire, his compatriot, Fernand Braudel, began a multi-volume work, the aim of which, as its title made plain, was to uncover, to explore, to celebrate and proclaim what he called the identity of France, whose entire history, he believed, was that of a nation in the process of creating or recreating itself. Combining mysticism, exceptionalism and nationalism in an epic and elegiac narrative, Braudel's last incomplete work was an unmistakably Gaullist account of France's national past, beginning in the mists of time and ending with disparagement of the Vichy regime and homage to the wartime resistance. "I have never ceased," the author wrote in his introduction, "to think of a France buried deep inside itself, a France flowing along the contours of each age-long history, destined to continue, come what may." Inspired by a sense of civic duty and a pent-up patriotic piety, this enterprise was a belated opportunity for Braudel to demonstrate and to declare his lifelong love for France, which he admitted was a demanding and complicated passion. And in writing this age-long history of his nation, which, unlike other aspects of the past, he understood almost instinctively, Braudel cast his account in the recognisably binary terms that were inseparable from the creation and the articulation of any collective identity, as France against the world, which in practice usually meant France against England or France against Germany. Yet Braudel's extended, unfinished love letter to the identity and exceptionalism of France represented the late life endeavour and declaration, or alternatively, the misguided recantation and apostasy, of a scholar who had made his academic and his public reputation by denouncing and transcending what he once disparaged as the usual framework of national histories in which every historian worthy of the name has long since ceased to believe. Inspired by such innovative analyst scholars as Marc Bloch and Lucien Febvre, Braudel had spent most of his career proclaiming that history should no longer be written along exclusively national lines. And in his first and most famous book, published in 1949, entitled The Mediterranean and the Mediterranean World in the Age of Philip II, he furnished a pioneering and bravura example of how to approach the past in a very different way, in deliberate opposition to what he termed the frankly traditional national historiography of historians such as Leopold von Ranke. For Braudel was convinced in this earlier phase of his life that the bounded territorialities, the parochial differences, and the petty quarrels of nation-states were too narrow a field and too constrained a subject for serious historical inquiry. And he dismissed all of this as l'histoire évanouissante, as the flotsam and jetsam of superficial happenings and short-term episodes, which were insignificant compared to the more deep-rooted patterns, trends and developments concerning the environment, climate, demography, production and consumption, which he believed formed the essentials of of man's, and we would now say woman's past. From this very different viewpoint, which Brodel had earlier espoused, history was not so much the pious handmaid of national identity, but rather its implacable enemy. For nations per se, this is Brodel again, were abstractions, if not accidents, radically disjointed and epitomized versions of an infinitely more complex whole. The zeal, energy, commitment, and contradictoriness with which, during the course of his long and distinguished career, Fernand Braudel moved from one position to another, which was its exact polar opposite, suggestively illuminates both the strengths and the weaknesses, the attractions and the limitations of regarding the nation as the most significant focus and resonant form of collective human identity and hostility in the secular great power world that allegedly came into being in the aftermath of the Peace of Westphalia. In his earlier iconoclastic days, Braudel was not only reacting against the prevailing belief that the nation was the prime unit of historical action and group awareness, but he was also signalling his hostility to the part that had so often been played and was still then being played by historians themselves in the deliberate and self-conscious creation of these often adversarial national identities. Moreover, by refusing to analyse the past in what he regarded as such blinkered, parochial and chauvinistic terms, Braudel was implicitly suggesting that for many people, national identity was not the only form of collective human solidarity that mattered, and nor was it necessarily the most significant form. Yet in his later and more conservative phase, Braudel argued instead that national identity was a more significant and long-lived phenomenon than those who claimed it had only begun in 1648 or in 1789 or later. And he seemed to imply that the nation-state and national identities were not only the most important form of collective association, but that they were also the culmination of all of human history that had gone before, and it was the obligation of historians, in fact, to say so. The contradictions, paradoxes, and ambiguities of Braudel's changing and inconsistent perspectives are a cautionary reminder of the many contradictions, paradoxes, and ambiguities of the nation as a form, perhaps the preeminent current form, of collective human identity. And I'd like this evening, in the course of the time I've got, to meditate, as it were, on these contradictions and paradoxes, looking at the late medieval and early modern notions of national identity, at 19th century notions of national identity, and then at national identity in the 20th century and on into our own time. It's a bit of a canter across the centuries, I'm afraid, but I hope that it might enable me to draw out some general themes at the end which will be of interest and relevance to the theme of this festival. Most recent attempts to define national identities focus on the history, geography, territoriality, and language of collective allegiances and collective antagonisms, and on the alignment of a national culture and the nation state. And they have been crafted so as to fit and describe what is believed to be, by many historians, the formative phase of nation building and national confrontation that took place in Europe from the late 18th century onwards, and since then, for good or ill, has spread across and around the whole world. During the last 20 years or so, this modernist interpretation of national identity has received a new impetus following the collapse of the Soviet Empire into many separate nations, and has been advanced with great persuasiveness and widespread influence by such scholars as Benedict Anderson, John Bury, Ernst Gellner, and Eric Hobsbawm. All of them sought to treat the subject in historical terms, but they've done so over a relatively short and circumscribed time span. None of them were particularly friendly to the very idea of national identity, and all of them thought that it was a recent and, they hoped, an ephemeral phenomenon that might already be on the wane. Yet it's not actually clear that such a view of the nation and of national identity as being an upstart and transient form of collective solidarity and group conflict is correct. And certainly in recent years, medieval and early modern historians have insisted that the essential and exclusive link that's been asserted between modernity and national identity is in fact mistaken. Indeed, one of them has gone so far as to urge that it's the similarities between medieval and modern expressions of national identity that are fundamental and the differences that are peripheral. Well, what are the arguments in favour of that claim? The argument put forward here is that in the aftermath of the decline in the West of the Roman Empire, a whole variety of new political and constitutional constructions came into being, which can, by the late medieval period, be described as nations. A truly national consciousness, according to one medieval historian, burst forth almost simultaneously in many European countries by the 13th century. One indication of this development is that when the Emperor Frederick II wrote in 1241 to his fellow rulers, warning them of the threat presented by the Mongols, he picked out the qualities of the different continental nations as follows. Germany was fervent in arms. France was the mother and nurse of chivalry. Spain was warlike and bold. And England was fertile and protected by its fleet. These stereotypes may have exaggerated the autonomy and territoriality of these nascent nations, but they also suggested that national identity was already in the 13th century an important element in a ruler's authority over his own subjects and in the assertion of power over his neighbours, and also in a broader sense of popular national consciousness as well. Medieval peoples themselves, another historian notes, seem frequently to have believed that they belonged to nations, and they used the words people and nation in their Latin form interchangeably and haphazardly. Various examples have been cited by historians in recent times in pursuit of this generalisation. In the case of England, the Venerable Bede, King Alfred, and Geoffrey Chaucer, the first writer in English explicitly to claim status as a national poet. And a general set of arguments that by the early 14th century, Englishmen felt themselves to be a nation. Similar arguments made for the France of Louis VI and Louis IX, and again, just as with Chaucer and the Venerable Bede, the great French national epic of the time, the Chanson de Roland. And as Alfred's battles against the Danes suggests, these burgeoning medieval national identities were often forged, defined, and strengthened as a result of war against a hostile and aggressive and or inferior enemy or other. Certainly so in the case of the English, to some degree at least against the Scots. The English and the Scots are constantly at war during this medieval period, one consequence of which in 1320 is that the Scots proclaim their collective identity as a nation against the English in the Declaration of Arbroath. The solidarity and separateness of the Scottish nation in which the people and the king were one whole community, a declaration which of course has been much revived in recent years in the era of Scottish nationalism. But it was predictably the animosity between the English and the French that was most significant in the creation of long-lasting national rivalries and national identities during this period, especially, of course, the Hundred Years' War between England and France, lasting on and off from 1337 to 1453 and producing a whole set of triumphs in battle on each side. The English are normally never told about the French triumphs and vice versa, and a whole variety of appropriate national heroes, the Black Prince and Henry V in the case of England, and Joan of Arc and Charles V in the case of France. As royal authority was solidified across large parts of Western Europe during the 16th, 17th and early 18th centuries, exerting its power over provincial elites and ordinary people alike in terms of fiscal, judicial and military control, it seemed as though the collective identities and national feeling and national consciousness were being correspondingly strengthened and intensified even more. And just as in the earlier period, a large part of this growth of national identity was as a result of the growth of national antagonisms. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, the enemy of England ceased to be the French and became instead the Spanish. And, of course, Gloriana identified herself closely with the English nation at war, as in her stirring Armada speech at Tilbury and in what became known as her Ditchley portrait. And it is, of course, that sense of English national identity that Shakespeare regularly and repeatedly celebrated. This royal throne of kings, this sceptred isle, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England. And, of course, in Henry V, cry God for Harry, England and St. George. And reciprocally, the same developments can be seen intensifying in Spain. Here is one Spanish grandee at the time of the Armada in 1588. If the honour of Spain is at stake, what Spaniard would fail to seek the fame and glory of his nation? So what we have here then, to some degree, I think, in deliberate contradistinction to those historians who've claimed that national identity is an invention of the late 18th century, what we have here is some evidence that some degree of collective national identity did exist in some places and in some times across medieval and early modern Europe. That war was a major force in this process of solidifying national self-definition and collective self-awareness, and that these embattled collectivities dramatized and depicted these conflicts, often in simple black and white, adversarial, Manichaean terms. But the fact remains, as Brodel, of course, argued so powerfully in his early period in the Mediterranean of Philip II, these national solidarities, identities, and antagonisms were often undermined by competing loyalties and collective identities, so much so, indeed, that another historian, Restoranum, has observed, it is difficult to assert that national consciousness held a primordial place in early modern political cultures, since such a force rarely, if ever, manifested itself overtly in an age still dominated by court politics, by localism, and by imperial papal universalism. Well, there's a lot to be said for that view. In medieval Christian Europe, the universal church, led by such popes as Gregory VII or Innocent III, and the universal monarchy of such Holy Roman emperors as Charlemagne, Otto the Great, and Frederick Barbarossa, forcefully countered the competing claims of particular nations, while the vivid and visible presence of the church in every town and village dominated the lives of ordinary people to a greater extent than any secular authority or national attachment. What is more, and as the example of the Holy Roman Empire suggests, secular power throughout this period was not so much national as dynastic in its geographical grounding and territorial articulation. At one extreme, the greatest sovereigns held their many lands as personal fiefdoms and in extended and elaborate territorial agglomerations. The Emperor Charles V was the classic exemplar of this form of composite monarchy, holding dominions in what would eventually become Austria, Hungary, Spain, Italy, Belgium, and the Netherlands, as well as rapidly expanding possessions in the Americas, each with their own laws, languages, cultures, and traditions. And that was simply an exaggerated version of what was true in later times of the kings of Spain, the emperors of Russia and Austria, and even the king of Great Britain, none of whom were sovereigns of single or unitary nations. The result of this was that at the beginning of the 16th century, there were altogether some more than 500 separate political units in Britain, in England, in Europe, I'm sorry, in Europe. And although that number had been significantly reduced by 1700, it was still in three figures, which suggests that the continuity of a world in which national identity was only dimly and unevenly developed. What is more, for the majority of people living out their lives in late medieval or early modern Europe, their sense of territorial identity was often very local. They rarely strayed in the course of their whole lives, which were normally over by 40, more than 20 or 30 miles from the place in which they were born. They spoke local and regional dialects rather than uniform or imposed or agreed national languages. And for many of them, their sense of identity could have been articulated in all sorts of ways, but the notion of there being a national identity, a single national identity, and the notion that that was the preeminent identity that they held is not, I think, particularly sound. So it's a complicated picture in late medieval and early modern Europe, and the same is true, in fact, when we come to the classic age of nationalism from the late 18th century onwards. Ample evidence, of course, that this was the classic age of nationalism. The American rebellion against Britain in 1776 and the creation of a nation, revolutionary and Napoleonic France unleashing unprecedented nationalistic forces, the rebellion of the Spanish colonies against Spain in the late 1810s and the early 1820s, New old nations consolidated in France and Spain and Russia, and new nations belatedly unified, such as Italy and Germany. Many of these nations and several others would eventually be caught up in the First World War, when millions volunteered out of a shared sense of national loyalty and patriotic identity, when total wars of populations superseded limited wars of armies, and when dying in battle for one's nation became the ultimate sacrifice. The Harvard historian Charles Mayer, trying to give some more specificity to this general point, has argued that the heyday of the nation state, defined and understood in these terms, both as a historical formation and as the preeminent form of collective human identity and solidarity, may be precisely dated as beginning during the 1860s, just before de Gaulle was born. And as such, it was built around the notion of territoriality, by which he meant the control of bordered political space, which in turn created the essential framework for the exploitation of material resources, for the wielding of political power, and for the creation of common notions of national consciousness and shared citizenship. This, Mayer argues, was not just a European phenomenon, but a global development, taking place in the United States in the aftermath of the Civil War, in Japan following the Meiji Restoration, in Germany with unification and in Italy with the Risorgimento, in the Austrian and Hungarian halves of the Habsburg Empire, and in countries such as Canada, Mexico, Argentina, and Australia, all the way around the globe. National societies were forged and reforged, according to Mayer, during the second half of the 19th century, in what was often a period of rapid and violent transformation, witnessing the strengthening of central government institutions at the expense of local or regional or state authority, the continued mobilization of internal and external military capacity as a resource for governance, and the development of an institutional infrastructure based on the technologies of coal and iron as applied to long-distance transporting of goods and people and on the mass production of industrial goods assembled by a large, growing factory and increasingly unionized labor force. From this perspective, the late 19th century nation as a unit of collective loyalty assimilated, subsumed, overwhelmed and incorporated all other forms of human awareness and identity. As the years from 1870 to 1914 have been described as witnessing the transformation of peasants into Frenchmen, Eugene Weber's famous phrase, or into Germans or Italians or Spaniards or Russians, and also of workers, the middle classes and even aristocracies and monarchies into national loyalists too. Many processes whereby this was brought about, the growth in universal, state-sponsored educational provision, teaching about the nation, the gradual expansion of the franchise to include those lower in the social scale, and in some cases even women as well. The rise of mass political parties and charismatic political leaders, such as Gladstone, Cavour, and Lincoln. The early provision of programmes of state welfare beginning in Bismarck's Germany. The imposition by many nations of protective tariffs. All of this, then, appeared to bring about a world in which the nation-state was the ultimate form of human identity. And it was celebrated in a whole range of unprecedented rituals and ceremonies, often focused on monarchs, but also on presidents as well, in the case of republics. Well, it's been argued that the outcome of these trends was that entire populations were, as George Macaulay Trevelyan put it, now thinking in nationalities. And to this unprecedented phase of thinking and feeling, historians themselves contributed more markedly than had their medieval and early modern predecessors. For they produced best-selling books which appealed to the mass reading public that was now being educated in elementary and secondary schools and in colleges and universities. Hence the rise to prominence of such writers as Macaulay and J.R. Green and later Trevelyan himself in Britain, of Michelet and Guizot in France, of Parkman and Bancroft in the United States, and of Ranke and Mommsen in Germany. All of them writing narrative histories, tracing the rise of their respective nations, urging that each of them was, of course, exceptional and providentially blessed, that they were superior to the rivals with whom they'd often gone to war, and that military triumph had set the seal on national consciousness, and that as a result they had long existed as unified, distinct, homogeneous, and monolithic national communities. Such writers provided a powerful shared sense of national memory, which was an essential prop to any collective sense of national identity. By providing, as it were, a national narrative reaching long into the past, which reinforced a sense of identity in the present and looking forward to the future. Well, that's the argument for the view that it is the late 19th century, as it were, as a result of the forces unleashed by the French Revolution, which sees the creation of national identities which are solid and mass-based and significant in a way that hadn't been true in late medieval and early modern times. But this argument, too, cannot, in fact, be pushed too far. Just as there were limits to the national identities of medieval and early modern times, the same was true in this later period, when national identities were, undeniably, more developed and more all-encompassing than before, but only up to a point. To begin with, the very idea that the belligerents that went to war in 1914 were unified, homogeneous nations does not survive detailed historical examination. When Italy was unified at the time of the Risorgimento, one contemporary observed, "We have made Italy, but now we have to make Italians." Since less than 5% of the population used Italian for everyday purposes, there was, to put it mildly, clearly a long way to go. Likewise, in France during the same period, almost half the school children engaged with French as a foreign language rather than as their native tongue, and that may well have been an underestimate. It was a similar picture in Germany, where in the East many spoke Polish as their first language, whereas in Alsace and Lorraine to the West there were many who spoke French. The same, of course, was true in Russia, where educated people conversed in French, but where workers and peasants used a wide variety of Slav languages and dialects. And in Austria-Hungary, the array of different tongues was almost bewilderingly varied, including German, Czech, Italian, Hungarian, Polish, Croatian, and Greek. So it was scarcely surprising that many of the Habsburg Emperor's subjects were multilingual, speaking one language at school or at work, but another language at home. If a single, shared, and uniform tongue is one of the essential attributes in common that are deemed to make up collective national identity, then none of the major powers that went to war in 1914 could be accurately described as a nation. As Eric Hobsbawm notes, there were in Europe few enough genuinely homogeneous nation-states, Portugal being a very rare and thus oft-cited example. What is more, and as that linguistic evidence suggests, although it's argued that more and more people, indeed whole populations, were being brought within the bounds of the nation during this period, there were in fact many people in these ostensibly unitary and all-enfolding nation-states who felt excluded from the shared politics and customs of national life, or who wished to be excluded from them. The electorates of the late 19th and early 20th century may have been wider than ever before, but universal male suffrage was limited to France and Switzerland, and very few women anywhere had the vote. In Britain in 1914, only 60% of adult males possessed the vote in parliamentary elections, and all women were disenfranchised, which meant that less than one-third of the adult population played any part in the process of electing the House of Commons, and of course nobody played any part in electing the House of Lords. What is more, many of these nations were contested rather than consensual constructions. In the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, there were growing demands during the late 19th century for independence for Scotland, Wales, and especially Ireland. And some sense of linguistic nationalism lay, of course, at the root of that. There were similar rejections of the notion of a single uniform Spanish nation by the Basques and the Catalans, and of a single uniform nation by, among others, the Finns, the Armenians, the Georgians, and the Lithuanians. Far from being homogeneous, therefore, most of the nations of late 19th and early 20th century Europe were polyglot, multilingual, and ethnically diverse. And these varied competing identities constantly undermined the calls and claims of a single unified national solidarity. Most of these political constructs in Europe before 1914 that I've just described were not in fact homogeneous, unified, collective nations. On the contrary, they were heterogeneous, polyvalent, multicultural empires. And these were not the only conglomerates that can be more appropriately described in that way than as nations with single national identities. That description would, for instance, be equally valid in the case of China, another monster territorial agglomeration encompassing many languages, ethnicities, and religions. The same was true of the United States, which had created a land-based empire by conquering and settling a continent, and which was becoming an increasingly diverse melting pot as immigrants poured in from southern, central, and eastern Europe in the decades before the First World War. But empire also came in another guise which undermined specific senses of national identity, namely the transoceanic model. As you don't need me to tell you, for example, the British Empire spawned dominions of settlement in Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, and here in Australia. But these were not so much separate nations as overseas Britannic offshoots. And many of their English-speaking inhabitants saw themselves as being British first and foremost, rather than Canadians or New Zealanders or South Africans or Australians. Until, of course, in this country, Robert Menzies, who famously described himself as being British to his bootstraps. From this perspective, most of these things called nations that existed as the 20th century began were more complex and more varied phenomena, and their far-flung transoceanic imperial boundaries in deserts and jungles and snow-capped peaks were also much less precise and less policed than Charles Mayer suggests. In other words, the millions who volunteered in 1914 may have believed that they were doing so on behalf of their respective fatherlands, but in practice, and as Lenin himself rightly noted, the First World War was a global conflict between empires that simultaneously transcended yet subverted the particular claims of national identities. There are other ways, too, in which the simplistic notion of the rise of the nation-state to preeminence by the late 19th and early 20th century just won't work. Although it's true in some ways, for example, that monarchs, emperors, were seen as foci of national identity, the great royal houses of Europe also saw themselves as an elaborate, transnational, pan-continental European cousinhood, marrying into each other's houses and speaking, as it were, each other's languages. Lower down the social scale, a family like the Rothschilds was far more interested in banking in every great financial centre of Europe than in feeling any particular sense of national identity with any one country in particular. In Britain, the Great Exhibition of 1851 may have been the symbol of the nation's economic preeminence as the workshop of the world, but it was also a celebration of internationalism, harmony, and common humanity as well. Marx and Engels got this point themselves. The bourgeoisie, they wrote, has through its exploitation of the world market given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. And the result was that by the mid and late 19th century, the world was now characterized by the universal interdependence of nations. Take, for example, the North Atlantic during this period, where people, goods, capital, production techniques and ideas all conveyed themselves across national borders and were in no sense constrained by them. I've already mentioned emigration from Europe to large parts of North America. There's a sense in which the great industrial areas of the Ruhr, of Britain, of Western Pennsylvania, and of other parts of North America had much more in common with each other in terms of what they were doing, modes of production, the people who were involved, than they did with the nations to which they belonged. There was a sense in which the development of welfare politics and progressive ideas, again, evolved on the basis of transnational discussions, not just in North America and in Western Europe, but here in the Antipodes as well. These, then, are some of the reasons why Dan T. Rogers has argued that it's wrong to focus exclusively on the nation-state, on national solidarities, and on national identities as the preeminent form of human association. For to do so, he argues, is to distort the fundamental forces and to neglect the many competing identities that were at work across the long 19th century. And what was true of the transatlantic world, which Rogers investigates very brilliantly, also held good across the Pacific and Indian Oceans, where similar movements of people, capital, technology, and ideas showed scant regard for the boundaries of nations. Not surprisingly then, and parce George Macaulay Trevelyan, contemporaries did not think or act exclusively in terms of nationalities. They still, and even increasingly, thought and acted in terms of internationalities too. As Frederick Jackson Turner put it in 1891, ideas, commodities, refuse the bounds of a nation. This is true especially in the modern world, with its complex commerce and means of intellectual connection. Well, this essentially interconnected world, characterized by multinational and composite monarchies, rather than by nation states precisely expressing and embodying and articulating coherent national identities, and underpinned by the relatively unhindered movements of people, money, goods and ideas across the oceans and around the globe, crashed into ruin in 1914 to 1918, with the defeat and the disintegration of four great transnational, land-based, multilingual and polyethnic empires. That is to say, the Russian, the German, the Austro-Hungarian and the Ottoman. And it was, ironically, Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States, itself, in fact, one of the surviving land-based, polyglot, multi-ethnic empires, though never admitting to that, which hosted an increasingly multi-ethnic population, who insisted that the problem with pre-1914 Europe was that it had been characterized by too many empires, but by too few nations. Hence, as Wilson saw it, the task of the peacemakers was to reconstruct Europe and the Middle East according to what he called historically established lines of allegiance and nationality, by creating nation-states out of the wreckage of the former empires as the most important units of collective human loyalty and identity, and in which all citizens would speak the same language and come from the same ethnic stock. By thus better aligning nation-states with national identities, on the basis of rational principles and democratic ideals, Wilson believed that he would bring into being a new, better, and more stable world. Hence the appearance, and in some cases the reappearance, of Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Austria, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and the Irish Free State. Never before had so many names so suddenly appeared or reappeared on the map of Europe. But in reality, the peoples of these regions were so mixed up together that it was impossible to create uniform nations and homogeneous identities in accordance with the grand and naive simplicities of Woodrow Wilson's doctrine of self-determination. He was, of course, president of Princeton University, so I hope it won't seem wholly disloyal if, as it were, I'm mildly critical of him. But then they do say at Princeton that it was a step down from being president of Princeton to being president of the United States. In 1919, the somewhat bewildered American Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, asked himself, when the president talks of self-determination, what unit has he in mind? Does he mean a race, a territorial area, or a community? These were good questions, which were never satisfactorily addressed, let alone answered, because the nations that were re-established or newly created, allegedly on the basis of national and linguistic homogeneity, were unavoidably multi-ethnic and multilingual. Poland, as reconstituted, contained more than 2 million Germans and 3 million Ukrainians, as well as Belarusians. Czechoslovakia, according to Lloyd George, was a polyglot and incoherent amalgam of Czechs, Slovaks, Magyars, Ruthenes, and Germans, while Yugoslavia was populated by Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, Albanians, and Hungarians. So much in practice for Woodrow Wilson's much-vaunted principle of national self-determination. Eric Hobsbawm's verdict is damning as a basis for redrawing the national boundaries of post-war Europe and for creating national identities. It was utterly impracticable and it did not work. The result, then, of all this meddlesome mapping at the close of the First World War was that much had changed, yet very little had changed. Before 1914, the land-based polities of Europe and also of the Middle East were not so much nations as imperial agglomerations with many ethnicities, languages and religions. And after 1919, the new nations of Europe were smaller units of political authority, but they still contained many ethnicities, languages and religions, which made it difficult for many of them to establish any viable or enduring collective sense of solidarity or national identity. Well, just as the years after 1919 had witnessed this flawed creation of nations and national identities in Europe, the three decades after 1945 saw similar developments, albeit taking place over a longer time span and covering a greater area of the globe. Once again, a whole array of new nations were suddenly brought into being, but this time in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere in the Third World, as, of course, the European imperial powers gave their empires away with varying degrees of enthusiasm or regret. In virtually every case, and in a recognisably familiar way, the indigenous politicians who were leading the fight for freedom and liberation sought to define their new nation and to unify their followers by exploiting and fomenting opposition to the hostile other that was represented by the imperial metropolis and its local proconsular agents. And in most cases, the former colonies were launched on their way to independence with the familiar and essential accoutrements of national autonomy and shared identity. Not just a state structure and government bureaucracy, but also flags, anthems, stamps, currency and ceremonials, and foundation myths and founding fathers, duly celebrated in new national histories and in statues and in public monuments. Well, the difficulty is that as with the new nations created in the aftermath of the First World War, so with those that came into being in the decades after 1945, the constructs of instant independence did not easily or closely correspond to the conventional ideal of unified coherence or shared identity. East of Suez, Britain's Indian Empire was brutally partitioned, and this was done largely and hurriedly on the basis of different religious affiliations which seemed clear rather than national identities which didn't. In the case of Africa, the colonial boundaries, which would subsequently become national borders, had been agreed by the representatives of the European powers when they divided up most of the continent at the Congress of Berlin. Many of these boundaries were arbitrary and artificial, as they took no heed of historic precedents, local circumstances, or of tribal or ethnic or religious or linguistic groupings. As Chief Awolowo, one of Nigeria's leading nationalist politicians, observed in 1945, Nigeria is not a nation, it is a geographical expression. Accordingly, when African colonies became African nations, they often did so with no shared sense of territoriality, history, language, solidarity, or identity beyond that which had been briefly and superficially imposed by the now departing colonial power, and which had also been briefly and superficially displayed by the nationalists themselves as they agitated for independence, which was often the only issue on which they could agree among themselves. This means that in many cases it has been impossible to establish a common sense of national unity or collective identity on a sustained basis. Nations made by merging former colonies on independence have often struggled to cohere, as with Guyana, Yemen, Somaliland, and Cameroon, and also in the attempt to join the former colony of Eritrea to Ethiopia. In certain cases, religion has failed to hold nations together, as in the case of East and West Pakistan, which split up. In other cases, religion has driven nations apart. Nigeria and the Sudan have both been fissured and sundered since independence between a Muslim North and a Christian South, and of course the Sudan has actually now been divided into two. And tribal and ethnic divisions have on occasions resulted in protracted civil wars, sometimes culminating in secession and genocide, as in Zaire, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, and Uganda. Well, the final phase here of this episode is, of course, at least up until now, the consequences for the creation or recreation of a whole variety of new nations in the aftermath of the end of the Soviet Empire and the collapse of the Soviet Union, resulting in a whole variety of Eastern European nations becoming independent in a way that wasn't true before, in the reappearance of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, in the breakup of Czechoslovakia, in the even more terrible breakup of Yugoslavia, the emancipation of former Soviet republics bordering on Eastern Europe and the Black and the Caspian Seas, Moldavia, Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan, and also the independence of once Soviet republics in Central Asia as well. So the map has changed all over again for the third time in the 20th century. Is this because of an assertion or creation of strong, powerful, collective national identities? It's too soon, I think, to know, because it's only 20 years ago, and that doesn't give us enough hindsight to be really sure. It does seem clear that there were feelings of collective solidarity and national identity in certain parts of Eastern Europe. Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, certainly, where national identities had existed and been snuffed out, and to some degree in Hungary and Czechoslovakia, where there had been failed uprisings against communism earlier in 1956 and 1968, respectively. But elsewhere, it's not so clear. In Poland, for example, those people fighting for independence against Russia relied heavily on the patronage of the Catholic Church and on the support of the native-born Pope John Paul II. It turned out that it wasn't true when Stalin said the Pope had no legions. At least in Poland, the Pope had a very large number of legions indeed. In the new former Soviet republics of Central Asia, it seems to be the case that Islam was a more unifying force during the initial stages of disengagement from the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics than nationalist sentiment, which only developed later, if it developed at all. It also seems fairly clear, I'm quoting Tony Judd here, that in places like Belarus and Moldova, or Georgia and the Ukraine, there is far less evidence of any particularly strong sense of shared national feeling at all. That's, as it were, the specifics, in a way, of the history of nations in the 20th century and the ambiguities of national identity. But as we move into, as it were, the present time, there is, of course, a broader set of forces at work. The geographical underpinnings and convergences of what Charles Mayer called decision space and identity space, that he believed were of such significance during the heyday of the nation state, have been uncoupled and undermined. As national sovereignty has been ceded to a proliferating number of supranational agencies and global organizations, ranging from the European Union to the IMF and the World Bank, as immigrants move back and forth across national boundaries in ever greater numbers, from Mexico to the United States and from Eastern to Western Europe and from parts of Asia, of course, to Australia, as media moguls like Rupert Murdoch and international banks and businesses have put themselves effectively beyond the reach of national jurisdictions or of effective national regulation, as threats and challenges such as global warning and international terrorism require solutions on an appropriately transnational scale, and as heavy industry has been superseded by the new technologies of semiconductors, computers, and electronic data transmission, and as information and germs can cross the world at the flick of a switch, regardless of where the national boundaries are. From this perspective, and despite their recent and unprecedented proliferation, the nation-state and national identities are widely regarded as being among the most significant casualties of the still-emerging postmodern, post-communist, post-colonial, and globalizing world. As Benedict Anderson famously and provocatively argued, nations should not be seen in the way that de Gaulle saw them, as eternally existing and precisely defined units of geographic territoriality, state power, and collective solidarity, but rather as imagined communities, as transient, provisional, ephemeral, made-up associations encompassing a multitude of shifting boundaries and subjective identities, but not for long. From this perspective, there was and is nothing absolute, uniform, fixed, unchanging, or immutable about the late 19th or early 20th century European nation-state, or about those countries which have proliferated across and around the globe in the 100 years since. On the contrary, the nation was and is merely one temporary and contingent way of organizing, governing, and identifying large numbers of people, which rested and rests on the uncertain foundations of manufactured myths and invented traditions, and which was and is never as homogeneous or as unified as those earlier national historians or later scholars such as Charles Mayer have been inclined to insist. By exploding these myths and by undermining these traditions, many scholars from the 1970s onwards have no longer been concerned, as their predecessors were, to reinforce national identity. Instead of depicting and celebrating them as consensual constructs and collective solidarities with narratives existing back into the mists of time, historians are now more likely to describe nations and explain national identities as contested and disputed phenomena. And by approaching these previously hallowed subjects in such a skeptical way, they are themselves intensifying the crises of legitimacy and identity through which many countries are passing. Let me draw these remarks to a close. The least I think that can be said, looking around the world today, is that nations do exist in an astonishing array of different sizes and forms. There are multi-ethnic agglomerations, such as the United States, China, and post-communist Russia, which are territorial empires presenting themselves as unitary nations. There are old and more recent European nations, such as Britain, France, Spain, Germany, and Italy, but all of them face serious challenges to their identities, from separatist or religious minorities, or from incomplete reunification. France even has a Ministry of National Identity, which is a pretty sure guide that there's some trouble there. There are the new or recreated nations in Central and Eastern Europe and in Asia on the borders of Russia, whose solidarities and sustainabilities are far from certain. There are the artificial constructs of the Middle East and of Africa, where some nations scarcely hold together at all, and also former colonies in Asia and the older republics in Latin America, of which the same may be said. And, of course, you do not need me to remind you, you're devoting more serious and substantial sessions to it. There are former imperial dominions such as Canada, South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia, which have abandoned the traditional paradigm of from colony to nation and are trying to include their native peoples in a newly inclusive national narrative with varying degrees of awareness and success. All of this is but another way of saying that the early 20th century was not characterized by homologous nation states and homogeneous national identities across the globe, and nor is the early 21st century either. As the late Clifford Geertz rightly noted, the illusion of a world paved from end to end with repeating units that is produced by the pictorial conventions of our political atlases is just that, an illusion. So is it the case then that national identity is mythical, ephemeral, transient? Or is it the case that national identity is in fact the most substantial of all forms of identity? Because nations go to war, people die for nations, nations tax us, nations legislate for us, and nations make laws. No other form of identity, not even the Catholic Church, certainly not classes or genders or races or civilizations, do that. Can it seriously be maintained, then, that national identity is now or has ever been the preeminent form of collective human identity? I hope it will not seem a frivolous answer when I say that the answer to that question is yes and no. Thank you.
So David has agreed to answer a few questions. If you'd like to give your name, I think we have some roving microphones, and one question at a time. Thank you. Well, I think you've baffled them all.
Wonderful.
Is there a question at the back? Over here.
The question is, nationalism, of course, has been a very contradictory force, as you outlined. It has been associated with some very totalitarian regimes, you know, particularly fascism and so on. But it has also served, in some respects, as a way of protecting, perhaps, us, or it could serve as a way of protecting us from the ravages of multinationals and international corporations. I'm just wondering where you think it's all going, and some of the nationalisms are very murderous at the present, as we can see, in the conflict in the Middle East and between Israel and the Palestinians.
I think that a lot of these collective identities of which nations are one are, as it were, morally neutral. That's to say, they can be used for good purposes or bad purposes. And what determines that often has to be explained in very specific terms. It's certainly possible to argue that nations have done good. Most educational systems are national creations. They didn't exist before nations came into being. I mean, there is a historically demonstrable correlation and connection between those things. Most scientific progress has been sponsored by nations. which I don't think is altogether a bad thing. And it is nations which have ultimately, by extending the vote, involved more people, I think, in national affair, in political affairs than any other form of political organisation. So it seems to me that those would be examples of ways in which nations have done good. I think the virulent and destructive genocidal eruptions of nationalism that we have seen in the last 20 or 30 years, and for which there are, alas, plenty of historical precedents, are, as it were, the other side of it, and those are deeply dismaying and discouraging. And I think ethno-linguistic nationalism and ethnic cleansing is a deeply deplorable development. One of the things that has happened in the 20th century, which I didn't have time to go into, is that before the First World War, across the whole length and breadth of the Mediterranean, from Gibraltar to Alexandria and Aleppo and Istanbul, great trading cities were to be found in which the range of nationalities and ethnicities and religions was enormously varied because they all traded with each other and they all spoke each other's language. And all that goes in the course of the 20th century, except in Gibraltar, oddly enough, this bastion of last bastion of British colonialism, where in fact most people speak Spanish, there's a huge Jewish population, and it remains a kind of time warp world, not so much of the British Empire, but of these extraordinary multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-linguistic trading ports that existed all the way around the Mediterranean. So it is, I think, very difficult. I think nationalism is a Janus-faced phenomenon. That's to say, it does do good and it can do terrible harm. And that, I suppose, is the way with many powerful forces in history. And I think we need to be aware of that. I think one needs to understand, above all, the ambiguous nature of these identities. And I think the same is true of many others. As to where it's going, I mean, I confidently predicted in 1989 that Margaret Thatcher would win the next general election, so my powers of soothsaying are, as it were, inadequate to the point of being utterly non-existent. I think it's hard to know. I mean, I do think that it is the case that there is a sense, as I tried to suggest rather hurriedly at the end of the lecture, that nations are institutionalized in their claim on people to a greater extent than any other form of identity. They send you to fight and you can get killed. They levy taxes on you. They issue passports. They make laws that we have to live under. I mean, those are powerful jurisdictional imperatives. How far they create a sense of collective identity is perhaps moot, but there is a structure, as it were, in a way that there isn't even with the Catholic Church, and which, as it were, identities built around gender or race or civilization simply don't have. So I think it's, in that sense, it's not good enough, as I tried to hint right at the end, to say that nations are just imagined communities. They are institutional constructs as well, which involve us all, whether we like it or not. That isn't to say they can't break up, as we've seen over the last 20 years. That isn't to say that more of them may not break up. I mean, as the history of the last 200 years shows, you know, the map of Europe and other parts of the world is redrawn every generation. It's probably less likely in Australia because you occupy an entire continent, if that's what you're worried about. But it's not for me to say. But even in such a case as that, of course, there are ways in which nations change. I mean, you do not need me to tell you that in a whole variety of ways, this is an utterly different nation from what it was 50 years ago. In terms of who is here, recognition given to indigenous peoples, as it were, what the sense of collective identity or of what people would like to feel Australia stood for has changed dramatically. So even if, as it were, the institutional structures stay the same, what a nation might stand for or its collective sense of itself can change. So as historians always say, it's very complicated.
We have another question.
My name is Richard Curtin. I'm currently reading David Remnick's The Bridge, which is the account of the rise of Barack Obama. And it starts out with an account of his speech in Selma, Alabama, at the beginning of his campaign. Reading it, it makes me particularly aware of what extreme divisions have existed in the United States. And in fact, the very name of the book called The Bridge is talking about his ability to move across particular different divisions. From living in the United States, it seems in many ways that the US bears out that contradiction. On the one hand, a powerful nation state called the First Nation, but below the surface, full of major contradictions.
Yes, I think that Obama has become in many ways a kind of lightning rod for exactly that set of issues, because, of course, one of the points is that actually not everybody in a nation agrees on what it is about or ought to be about. And I think the Obama presidency has very much polarized that, even though he doesn't wish to present himself as a polarizing figure. He wants to present himself as someone who transcends these limitations, these collective categories. And he's written rather movingly about that. But it is interesting that, as it were, Obama's version of America is multi-ethnic, transracial, cosmopolitan. I mean, that's, as it were, you know, the fact that he was born elsewhere, and you know, I mean, within the United States, but not on the United States mainland, the fact that his father came from Kenya and so on, that Obama is, in a sense, a kind of cosmopolitan, multicultural figure in himself, seeking, I think, to suggest that that's the persona that the United States ought now to collectively grasp. But, of course, what we see in the Tea Party movement in America is an absolute both repudiation and fear of that. And what we see in the Tea Party movement is that the United States is not to be dominated by these cosmopolitan intellectuals, which is a coded phrase in his case, of course, for being a person of color. It's not to be dominated by these big cities on the East and West Coast, which are full of, you know, liberals, Jews, homosexuals, intellectuals, and all these other utterly deplorable people. That the real America is middle America, which is white and which is male and which is agricultural. And that's the America they feel these people are taking away. And it would be impertinent for me to say, but I cannot suppose that there aren't equivalent geographical and political formulations of what is the real Australia or not, as there are indeed of what is the real Britain or not. And I think those battles about, as it were, what constitutes a sense of national identity, is it outward-looking, cosmopolitan, inclusive, or is it turned in on itself, and in some senses, I think, very defensive and very frightened, I think those polarities and contradictions and confrontations about different notions of national identity are very pronounced in the United States at the moment, but they're not unique to the United States.
We have time for one final question at the very back.
Sir David, I'm Hans Baer. I'm wondering how you see world systems theorists have extended the ideas of Burdell and basically look at global capitalism as being a global integrating force, but one where you have a system of unequal exchange involving a core, a semi-periphery, and a periphery.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer the specifics of the question, but I can answer it at a more general level. It seems to me that one of the difficulties as a historian is that globalization is a sort of geographical version of the rising middle class. You know, it's always been going on. There's never been a century in the whole of human history when the world hasn't become more globalized than it was before, you know, in the century before. It's kind of always going on. And, of course, it's the illusion of every generation to believe that what's going on in its own time is more important than what's gone on ever before. All that said, I do think that in terms of the unrestricted movements of people especially, but also of capital and of ideas, and also, therefore, in terms of IT and in terms of the media and in terms of finance, we do live in a world where, to a greater extent than ever before, here I am buying into the, you know, it's always getting more globalized and it is more globalized than before. We do now live in a world, I think, where the power of the nation state to regulate any of these phenomena that I've just described is very limited because they are essentially transnational. It is impossible now to regulate the banks properly, in my view. I'm not against banks, but they do need regulating. It is impossible to regulate the media properly now, in my view. And those are only two examples. It's impossible on a national basis, here's a third, to deal with global warming, whatever the local political rouseabout that might be. And that, I think, does make things very difficult, because one of the arguments is, well, if no nation can regulate it, let's pack it in and not bother. You know, it's too difficult. And it's expensive, so we shouldn't do it. which has been resonating here recently quite a bit, and not just here. The other argument is, how do you create global structures of authority within which such regulations could be undertaken? And that hasn't really happened yet. That's to say, most of the global structures of authority that do exist are not about those issues. They're about sending peacekeeping troops into various parts of Asia and Africa. They're about trying to deal with AIDS. They're about trying to help finance developing countries to develop more. Those all seem to me to be wholly admirable things to do. But they don't, on the whole, it seems to me, get to grips with these genuinely global issues, which I think, in a wholly unprecedented way, are issues which nation states ought to try to work on, but which no nation state, even if it had the political will, can work on to a sufficient degree to sort it. And that, I think, is a very serious political challenge, and it's one that sooner or later is going to have to be engaged with.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to say farewell. Before thanking Sir David, I'd like to express our thanks to Patrick McCackie for his brilliance in organising this Festival Ideas. He's one of our greatest sons who has gone overseas and returns, thank goodness, to organise festivals like this. We salute you, honour you, and thank you, Patrick. We're also extraordinarily indebted to Professor Sir David Cannadine, who has given us a wonderful sweep of 1,000 years of national identity and left us still wondering where it's going to go the next 1,000 years. Thank you very much, Sir David. It's been an honour and pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is it all right?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.